or the handouts from past calls, any of this material. It's all on the same site, which, again, is salesgrowthblog.com / Vitamix. So it's all on the same URL. we're just going to dive right in and get started. Unless anybody had something so pressing or important or exciting that they wanted to share, they could do that now. Otherwise, we'll get started. All right, cool. So here's what we're going to do. Today, the topic of our call today, we're going to talk about having quality coaching conversations. And if you have the handout in front of you, I'll guide you through it. If you don't have it in front of you, I'll try and be as descriptive as possible so that you're okay with that. Because it does have a handful of visual diagrams. I even put a cartoon on page 2 for you guys. So I'm really hoping you got a chance to look at that. I thought that would keep you tuned in a little bit. All right. So let's move right into this. And if you guys go to page 2, before I actually get into the content on this page, you know, if you look at everything that we've talked about on all these calls so far, I appreciate you guys, you know, listening and taking the information in, because up until this point, you know, we've talked about a lot of ideas, some of which are applicable, but more of what we've talked about is, you know, on the first call we talked about really the framework of a high-powered sales organization, and then we talked about on the next call emotions, and you might see why we chose to go in that order, because having that understanding of how people process emotions, and you guys remember, and we're not going to completely review the call today, but you remember we talked about on that call the idea that, you know, most people, the way they deal emotionally is they avoid or they magnify, and we introduced the idea that, hey, you know, there's a more productive strategy for managing emotions, and as demonstrators, we see all the time and we experience it ourselves that dealing with the ups and downs of selling, the ups and downs of, you know, really running our own businesses, managing emotions is a relevant topic. Well, today we're going to talk about how do you take some of the things we've talked about and apply this within our role as regional managers, within our coaching conversations that we have with people. And I guess I should take a minute and, you know, define the word coaching. And some of you received a CD long time ago in the mail, back when Vitamix first brought me in to do some work. You may have received a CD where we talked about, that CD was on the topic of having quality coaching conversations. So you should recognize a couple of ideas today, although a lot of this is also going to be in addition to or above and beyond what you heard on that CD. But you may remember, and you may not, and that's okay, that on that CD I talked about the idea of the word coach, just so we all have the same definition. You know, the word coach really is derived from the idea of a stagecoach. You know, you hear the word coach used in sports. You hear it used in business. You hear athletes that have coaches. But really it originated with the idea of a stagecoach, which at the very core essence of the definition of coaching, it really just means helping somebody get from point A to point B. So as far as we're all concerned, just so you know, when I'm sharing with you the word or the idea or the topic of coaching, it's just any conversation where you're trying to help somebody, help them get a new result, help them adjust their attitude, help them to be more accountable. Those are all different types of coaching conversations. So let's go to, on page 2 here, there's a topic that I'm introducing called the 3 stages of leadership. And I'm going to tell you where I get this from. This framework that I'm sharing with you right now, I did not create. I'm borrowing it from a friend of mine. His name is Steve Farber. And he's an author, and he actually wrote some great parables on leadership. I'd encourage you guys to check out his books. One of them is called Radical Leap, and another one is called Radical Leap and Greater Than Yourself. He's written 3 or 4. Radical Leap, I think, was considered by a number of authorities, whatever that means, one of the top 100 business books of all time, which I think is cool because it's a parable, and those types of books don't normally make that list. But I learned this from Steve, and what he talks about is how, as a manager, we have to recognize these 3 stages. And, you know, the first stage, if you're looking at the diagram that I put on your handout, the first stage is where you grow yourself, right? Something that we're all constantly doing. We're trying to learn, trying to grow. It's part of what we're doing today. something we all understand. The second stage is when you give of yourself. And the idea of going from growing yourself to giving of yourself is as simple as, hey, I continue to learn how to do what I do. You know, each of you on this call, you guys are all experts in your own way or in a different level at demonstrating the Vitamix. And so as you grew your ability to demonstrate the Vitamix and then you became regionals, you know, part of how you give of yourself is just teaching other people how to demonstrate, right? Well, the third stage of leadership is what we call duplicating yourself. And there's a difference between giving of ourselves and duplicating. You know, you could look at it this way, that when we give of ourselves, you remember on that very first call we talked about there's the teacher and the artist, or in other words, there's the regional manager and the demonstrator, right? When we give of ourselves, you could look at that as, hey, I'm helping someone to be a better demonstrator. Duplicating yourself is different. Duplicating yourself is, how do I make sure that as I'm helping others, I'm doing it in a way so that they help others the way that I really want them to, right? In a way that makes it so eventually you don't have to be the one that's solving all the problems, putting out all the fires. So you'll notice in your handout on page 2 here that I highlight some of the common mistakes that cost us the ability to duplicate. And I'll tell you this information I'm about to share, where this comes from, it just comes from personal observation. Our company, Global Empowerment, we've worked with or observed or watched hundreds and hundreds of sales executives. And if you remember my definition of an executive, it's really a manager at the level that each of you is at, maybe above, maybe a below, depending on titles. But in reality, anybody who leads leaders, we've had a chance to observe, and I'm just going to share with you, you know, if this can shorten the learning curve, or if this can eliminate possible mistakes or help each of you, this is what we've noticed are some of the most common mistakes that cost us that ability to duplicate ourselves. Number one is, and you'll see these 3 points here are all fill in the blanks, or if you're just taking notes somewhere else, that's fine. Number one is what we call teaching what without the why. Teaching what without the why. So the point there is when we're teaching someone how to do something, you know, we could teach a demonstrator how to do something. But in our coaching conversations, if we can get in the habit of teaching somebody why we're telling them to do something a certain way, that's important, right? And we can come back to why that's important. But just that idea of teaching somebody what to do without them learning why to do it, you know, that creates a challenge because if I tell somebody what to do, but they're not fully educated on why I'm telling them to do it that way, and they don't fully comprehend the reasoning behind why. It's not just a matter of did I tell them why and they nodded their head. Can they turn around and teach that to someone else? Because if they can't, then by the time they do teach someone else, and it's now our training as it goes down the line, people don't understand the purpose, then we're losing a core element of what people need. They need to know why are you doing it this way, right? Here's the second common mistake that costs us the ability to duplicate, and that's what we'd call motivating through fear. Motivating through fear. Now, the question often comes up, John, how do you define motivating through fear? Because I think I know what that means, and usually a manager will say, I don't think that I do that, right? But what does it mean to try and motivate somebody through fear? And what it means to motivate through somebody through fear is when we overemphasize negative consequences and we don't connect to somebody the positive consequences of doing something. So we'll actually talk more about that later today, and that'll actually fill in what that means to say we motivate others through fear. Even though some of us on the call, we may not consciously think, well, I don't motivate others through fear, one of the things we have to recognize is that anytime we have a conversation with somebody where we only focus on what I'd call a negative consequence or what will happen if they don't do what they're told to do, versus connecting it with positive consequences, we are essentially motivating through fear. We'll talk more about that. The third common mistake, and this is a big one here. This is one of the easiest mistakes to make when we're trying to duplicate ourselves as managers, right? It is relying on personality versus process. Relying on personality versus process. Now, what does that mean? And my guess is you guys don't really need me to fully explain what that means, but just so we're on the same page, what we're talking about here is, let's imagine you've got someone who's a great demonstrator. And they're great because they've got a great personality, right? And maybe because of that personality, customers connect with them. They love them. I was just up in Canada last week observing one of their sales meeting. I presented some training to them, and I got to meet all their demonstrators. And one of their top demonstrators was a young man who is he has this exceptional charisma. It's amazing. And everybody in that region and everyone from Vitamix who was there realizes this guy is just a special person. He's got a personality that is magnetic. And one of the challenges is, you have somebody like that who's succeeding, if they try and tell someone else, hey, the way to succeed is you just got to have my personality, right? Well, the problem is that's not always duplicatable. And so the idea here of personality versus process is, we've got to make sure that when we're coaching somebody, that we're not just relying on who somebody is as a reason to succeed, but we're trying to extract, well, what's teachable about what that person's doing? And for us as managers, we have to stop and recognize at times, hey, sometimes someone might listen to me because they like me, but if I want them to coach somebody else and they don't have that likability factor, they better be able to coach someone based on process, not just expecting that someone's going to listen to them because they're likable. So these are just some ideas I wanted to introduce today as some of the most common reasons why it can be difficult to duplicate ourselves, because these are all things that actually happen naturally. If you go through all three of these, it's very natural to get in the habit when we're coaching others to just talk about, here's what to do, what to do, what to do. You guys might notice, if you were to pick apart the calls that I'm running with you, there's actually a much higher percentage of energy dedicated to understanding why things work a certain way, because I respect that each of you is at a level where that's going to serve you. You don't really need me to tell you what to do when you get up in the morning and how to put your underwear on and how to call someone or how to talk to your demonstrator. So a lot of this is why certain things happen, because I know that you'll take that awareness and apply it however you proactively want to apply it. Same thing with motivating through fear. It's not like that's the type of thing that we do on purpose or that it makes us a bad person. It's just something that happens. Relying on personality versus process, same thing. It happens naturally. So for the remainder of today's call, what I hope to do is to give you guys some tools and some strategies so that when you go into every conversation you have, you've got tools that you can rely on so that you can consistently help people to improve their results. And at some point, if you want to work with one of your demonstrators and ask them to be great coaches of other demonstrators, feel free to take any of this information and share it with them. On the second page, before we turn to page three, you'll notice I've got a quote there in a box, and it's the idea of how we coach one person will determine how they coach the next person. And so as a final thought on this first topic, just keep that in mind, that how each of us communicates and works with the people around us is how they're going to work with others around them. All right, so just something to think about. I guess I'll stop, and before I start on page three, just open it up and I can't see you guys, so I don't know. I don't know if you're shaking your heads or nodding your heads or what you're thinking. And you guys have any thoughts, feedback, opinions, anything you want to interject before we go to the next page? Anything is helpful, too, because I can't see if there's any thoughts that you have. Not all at once. You guys might clog the phone line.
Just anticipating the next page. It's good.
Oh, all right, good. All right, you're all still there?
Yes.
All right, that's okay. Perfect. Turn to page three. If you don't have the handout, I'll describe this well, so nevertheless, you'll be the same. I wanted to talk about today and introduce to you guys as a group what I call higher-level preparation. What I mean by higher-level preparation is, I know that you guys have been around for so long that, when you go to have a conversation with somebody, you guys probably have your own process that you might go through. You might think about, hey, what am I going to want to talk about today? And so what I want to give you are really some questions that you can use to make sure that you have done the level of thinking that's going to allow you to extract the maximum value from every conversation that you have. So I'm going to go through each of these questions. Some of them I'll spend less time on than others, so I might move quickly at times and at others give more explanation. The first question in what I call your coaching preparation checklist is, of course, am I in the right emotional state? And if you have your pen or you're taking a note, I'd write down this phrase next to that question, emotional agility, emotional agility. You know, Greg, on one of our last calls, I love the example that you gave. You talked about how you brought up the question of, hey, you know, sometimes when you're trying to get through to somebody and they're not doing what they said they're going to do, it can be frustrating, right? And I think one of the things that we can probably all acknowledge is that that's always going to happen. And as managers and as leaders who have to lead by example, it's so important that even though we know this, we got to check in, make sure that we're in the right emotional state. And if anything, we got to make sure that we are willing to be emotionally agile. What that means is, hey, we got to be ready in case someone says or does something that really sets us off. We've got to be ready to be grounded in the emotional state that we need to be in to be able to better serve somebody. You guys remember on last call we talked about, hey, when your emotions are high, intelligence is low. So we have to exemplify that, right? I'm going to go right now to the next question. This is an interesting one. Am I willing to serve without being attached? Am I willing to serve without being attached? Let me clarify what this means. When I say being attached, you know, what I'm really talking about here is when we're trying to help somebody and they are stuck in their own drama or their own story. You know, I think this is one of the reasons, and it's kind of a problem that we have as a culture, but this is a reason why people are so fixated on television or specifically reality TV, is because human nature is to love drama, right? I mean, we've known that for thousands of years. People love drama, and they love getting sucked into stories. Well, when we coach others, we got to make sure that we don't get sucked into their story, because what happens is we'll often take on their negative energy. So that's what I mean when I say, am I willing to serve without being attached? I think it's important that we not get sucked into someone else's energy, especially when we as regional managers can sympathize. I'm going to suggest empathize, don't sympathize, all right? Understand, don't attach to someone else's story or energy, because that might put you in a place where you can't really give them the higher level coaching that they need. And we'll get into what that might mean in a little bit, but these are just some interesting questions to consider. The third question is, I think this is a good one. Am I willing to do whatever it takes? Am I willing to do whatever it takes? You know, when you think about times when, as managers, you guys have probably had this, where you're on the road, you're having multiple conversations, you're putting out multiple fires. This could be the description of what you did today before you get on the call, right? And you have all these conversations you're trying to have. You're trying to manage multiple relationships, and everybody's in a different place. Sometimes it's fatiguing. It's draining, not just mentally, emotionally, physically, right? And I think it's important that before we connect with someone, any type of coaching conversation, whether it's live with a demonstrator, you know, when you're out in the field, or it's over the phone, and to decide, hey, am I willing to do whatever it takes, which sometimes means bringing the energy when I don't want to. Sometimes being willing to do whatever it takes means telling somebody what they need to hear, not what they want to hear, which takes energy. It takes energy, right? So that's an interesting question. This next one here really gets technical when you start to think about the kinds of conversations you're going to have, and I'm going to ask you to add something to this question. And the question on the handout is this. Is this a strategy or accountability conversation? In other words, what I'm talking about is, when you guys are planning out your week and you're thinking about who on your team you're going to be talking to, who you're going to be seeing, and you're thinking about what kinds of things probably need to be brought up in these relationships, you might ask the question, is this person or is this conversation, does it deserve what I call strategy coaching, which is, hey, helping that person to get better at a certain aspect of their demonstration? Or does the conversation deserve more of an accountability conversation, which might be you got someone who you know they know what they should be doing, but they're not doing it. That's a different type of conversation. And what I'm suggesting today is it will serve you to think ahead of time before your conversations with someone as to, hey, which kind of conversation is this? And I'm going to suggest that you add a third kind to this as well, because I believe there's three types of coaching conversations. If you had to break every coaching conversation, or you could even say if you had to break every conversation that you have with your demonstrators into one of three categories, I'd say they all go in one of these three. Obviously, one is strategy, one is accountability. The third is relationship building. You know, you might have some situations where the kind of conversation that is needed is a relationship building conversation. And I think it's important that at this point I point out to all of you that as coaches or managers, the thing we have to be careful of is that we don't always gravitate towards our preferred style of coaching. You know, for example, if the way that I like to be coached by my managers or my peers or my partners is I want them to just be direct and get right to results, which happens to be for me, I want things to be direct. I don't really care about the relationship building. I just need to get results because that's my model of the world, right? Well, if I turned around and that's how I coached everybody, what about the person who really needs and desires and is looking for the recognition of them as a person? They want a relationship with me, and if I treat them the way that I want to be treated, people are going to be disconnected. I'm not going to have influence over them because what they needed was the relationship building. So I'm just going to throw that out there as a thought that as you look at everybody that you lead and as each of you adds people to your team over time and you think about the people you're leading and, you know, what you've had, what's gone on in those relationships and the directions you'd like those relationships to go, it's just a good question to ask before your conversations. Does this need more strategy, accountability, or relationship building? Now, the question might come up, maybe I'm answering it ahead of time, you know, do these all need to be different conversations? No, you could have one conversation where you address an accountability issue, where you address a strategy issue, and you do some relationship building. I'm just saying it's important to distinguish and separate them, at least in your own mind, before you connect with somebody, because that'll help you to realize, hey, wait a minute, this relationship needs more of this right now. And if you guys have questions or we want to clarify any of this, we'll stop in just a second here. The next question on this, on the third page here, on your coaching preparation checklist, it's another interesting one. What is the trajectory of this relationship? What is the trajectory of this relationship? I'll tell you guys, one of the things that I do in my business is for the last 5 years, I've probably had well over 5,000 phone calls with a client who is some variation of a paying coaching client. And one of the things that I do is every time I get off that call, see, I have so many people that I'm managing or working with, I don't expect myself to remember all the details. So I will often make notes. You know, I got a real simplistic, old school filing system. I make notes on every conversation I have. And they're not going to be complex, in-depth. I don't get off the call and write an essay about what we talked about. But I'll make a note so that before the next conversation, if I just glance at that note, it will remind me, hey, how have the past several conversations, how have they been going? Like, I don't mind telling you guys that on these calls, at the end of the call, I'll make notes and I'll point out, hey, was there anybody on the call where I felt like they were on one extreme or another in terms of either super positive or totally tuned out? Because I've got to make sure that, to be honest, without looking at those notes, I don't remember how you guys showed up to the last call. I got too many other things going on. So when I show up to this one, I'll glance at those notes, and if I start to see a pattern, then it might tell me, hey, you know, I got to check in with so and so, maybe in private, and find out if there's something going on or there's something that I'm not giving them from these calls. But this is the type of thing to keep track of and pay attention to, because for each of you, I know you guys all manage a different number of people, but I would suggest that you create a system for yourself where you can keep track of conversations. And if you're currently thinking, the little voice in your head is thinking, well, John, that's a great idea, I don't know if I need that right now, here would be my suggestion. To create a system that would work if you had another 100 demonstrators you were managing. Now, sometimes someone would say to me, but John, I don't need that. I don't have 100 demonstrators. Well, I come from a belief, and you don't have to have this belief, but it's just a belief that, you know, one theory is, hey, I'll wait till the world gives me 100 people to manage, then I'll build the system to manage it. I like the theory of, hey, dig the well before you're thirsty. Be prepared to manage more people before those people are given to you, so that as they're given to you, you have a process to manage multiple relationships more and more and more. I have some clients in other companies who manage, they literally do manage 50, 60, 70 managers, and they have to do this. But even if they had fewer, it would still serve them. So paying attention, keeping notes of what's going on in a relationship and asking, what's the trajectory of this relationship? Even if you guys aren't keeping notes on your conversations, I think it's still valuable just to ask that question. What's been going on? What is my relationship with this person? Is it headed in a certain direction right now? The last question I'm going to put out here on your checklist is, what structure will best serve this conversation? So if you're getting ready to talk with somebody, what I mean by structure is sometimes different types of coaching conversations really ought to be structured differently. You know, if you, and you could also tie this back into strategy compared to accountability compared to relationship building. You know, if you realize that what someone needs is a relationship building conversation, you might open up that conversation by saying, hey, I know we're always talking about your demonstration numbers, but I just want to check in. You know, how's the family? How you doing? Right? You mentioned you guys have a vacation coming up. Are you excited for that? Let's make sure that you get to really enjoy that. You know, that's a different structure than someone shows up where, let's say your plan wasn't to have a relationship building conversation. Maybe you have an issue that needs to be brought up, right? And, you know, there's a different structure when you need to bring up an issue with somebody. The structure when you're bringing up an issue, and I'll run this by you real quickly here, is, hey, number one, state the issue. Because one of the biggest mistakes we sometimes make is beating around the bush or not bringing right to the front that there's a problem, right? That oftentimes only makes things worse because people usually know when there's an issue that needs to be talked about. So number one, state the issue. You know, if I said, Ed, we've got a real problem here, right? And the thing that I want to discuss today, Ed, is, you know, I'll make something up, is your attitude at the last, you know, the last time we spoke, right? And then number two is to give an example of what I'm talking about. Because so often when we try and bring up issues with other people, we end up having a conversation, but we, in our minds, we both have two different examples of what we think the actual problem is. So I'll say, Ed, the example is, you know, when I brought up this idea and you responded this way, that's what I'm talking about, right? And then the third thing I'll say is I'll say, Ed, when that happened, here's how that makes me feel. It makes me feel like, you know, it makes me feel like I'm not doing a good job in helping or serving you as a leader, right? It's important to tell people, to let people feel or hear our emotions when we're putting an issue out there. We want them to know that it's creating pain for us, and it also brings a humanity to the conversation. The fourth step when bringing up an issue is to take ownership. This might be one of the most important. I would say, Ed, and you know, what I've got to share with you is that I really believe I contributed to this problem because, you know, I didn't share with you in the past my expectation for how we're going to work together, et cetera, et cetera. So taking ownership of any situation is critical as the leader, right? Because that way someone's going to be less defensive. The fifth step is to say, hey, here's what's at stake. What's at stake is, and the reason why it's important to tell people what's at stake is because people need to know that, hey, we got to resolve this. What's at stake is, you know, our working relationship together. Or what's at stake is, you know, we need to get your results up. If we don't, you know, what do you think that's going to lead to? So we got to tell people what's at stake. And then the fifth step and final step is to share somebody that it's important for you to resolve this right now. So I'd say, Ed, you know, here's what's at stake, and I want you to know that it's important to me that we resolve this as soon as possible. And then after that, I'd just ask him, I'd invite him for thoughts or ideas or suggestions. I'd say, what are your thoughts about the situation? And then begin, and then that just sets up a conversation. But what I just gave all of you there is an example of, hey, that's a structure that I might think through right before I have that issue conversation, which is a lot different than if I'm having a coaching conversation where I just want someone to give me some updates on what's been going on, tell me what's challenging them, and then ask me, you know, tell me what I can help them with, right? Different structures might serve different types of conversations. All right, let me stop myself for a minute, guys, because I know I've just kind of unloaded and dumped a lot of information, and, you know, I'd really appreciate any thoughts, questions, feedback, ideas on this page 3 or anything that we've been talking about. So the line is open. You guys have any thoughts, questions, ideas? Go right ahead.
Here's a question. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so if you have a rep that is, let's say at the from office level, you hear negative comments about they're the type of rep that's always complaining, then you start getting calls from Costco that, you know, that they're unhappy with some behavior or something. And so your own personal impression of this person after dealing with them is that they're a little bit negative, and they're not necessarily somebody that you would want to spend any time with necessarily. And perhaps when you do talk to them, their reaction, rather than being positive, no matter what you bring up, is they only want to talk. They don't want to listen. And so in building a relationship, do you try to build a relationship with each individual that you're dealing with? And if you don't have positive thoughts, do you just fake it?
Man, what a valid question. What a valid question. Here's my thought, Ed, and my thought is this. First of all, and we're actually going to talk more about this in the next segment here, but let's address different parts of your question here. Let's address the first part of your question of, look, what if that person's defensive and all they want to do is talk and they don't want to listen, right? One of the things we're going to talk about a little bit later on this call is what motivates people. And people are motivated always and only by one of two things, to move towards pleasure and away from pain. And again, we'll bring this up again, but when I say towards pleasure or away from pain, oftentimes what's going to get somebody to change their behaviors or change their habits is going to be they will only change when they realize that if they don't change, it's going to be very painful. I mean, let's look at health, right? I mean, I spent years in the health club business. You have a lot more people who decide they're going to start working out because the doctor told them, if you don't, you're going to have serious problems, than people who say, hey, I woke up today and wanted to start working out. So we really know at our core that people are more likely to do something to avoid pain than to gain pleasure. Now, let's take that example that you just gave, Ed, and apply that psychology. If I had a situation like that, and this is separate, by the way, from, you know, should you build a relationship with them or not? Because, look, I believe that, you know, you shouldn't fake anything. But at the same time, as the leader, your job is to serve this person and to do whatever it takes to help them to succeed, right? We can't always just say, hey, you know, slow to hire, quick to fire. If they don't work, I'm going to get rid of them, right? Because that's, you know, part of what we do is we try and help people to become better people, right? So my approach, Ed, would be that when I come to that person, I would say, hey, here's something I want to talk to you about. And I would use that formula that I just gave you. And what I would do, Ed, is I would make sure to share with that person that you don't believe it's a fact that that person has a – it's not a fact that that person has an issue. It's just a feeling that you're getting based on feedback you're getting from other people. And the reason why I'm saying this is because if we try and argue with somebody that their problem is a factual problem, we're actually going down into the level of the problem, and we're inviting a debate as to whether or not they're creating a problem. But if somebody sees that we're not saying, hey, this is a fact that you got a problem. I'm just sharing with you what I'm feeling based on this feedback. And at that point, what I would do, Ed, when I get to the point where I say, hey, here's what's at stake. What I would do with somebody in that situation is I would say, here's what's at stake. I'd say this person and this person and this person all gave feedback. And then what I'd do with that demonstrator is I'd say, let me ask you a question. If this is the kind of feedback that everybody's giving, what do you think that eventually – what path do you think that's sending your career towards, right? And what's nice is you don't have to tell somebody, hey, if you don't shape up, you're going to get fired, because most people in their core, in their hearts, they know if they are in the process of firing themselves. They know it. They may not admit it, but if you give them a chance to recognize that, oftentimes, not all the time, people will see if you say, hey, look, if this weren't to change, and I'm not saying these people are right, right? You're not making it an argument about facts. You're saying, I'm not saying these people are right, but if, you know, they believe they're right, and if everybody has that kind of feedback, what do you think is at stake here? And oftentimes by putting it in somebody's court, and by the way, that's not necessarily motivating through fear, or at least not motivating through fear unnecessarily. Sometimes the only way somebody will change is when they're able to feel the appropriate pain that they should be feeling. Sometimes somebody needs to recognize, wait a minute, I really am creating a major problem for myself. this isn't what other people are creating for me. They have to recognize they're creating it for themselves. So that's how I'd approach that part of the conversation. Ed, the second part of your question about building a relationship, I don't ever think that it's you want to be inauthentic with somebody. You know, you don't want to tell them that you're their buddy when you don't want to be their buddy. I don't think that's the point there. But I do think it's important to step in and let someone know that, hey, my goal is to help you to hit your goals. And I'm not doing my job if I don't tell you that, hey, when these three people give me this kind of feedback, you know, all I have to go off of is, hey, what direction is that sending you? That doesn't put me in a good place to serve you, right? So let me just stop for a second, Ed. Is there any part of your question that I didn't fully answer, or does that make sense the way I described that?
It does.
Was there any part of what I shared, by the way, that you think is helpful, or I'm just curious?
Well, yeah. The maybe the most important part is that I could hear in what you were saying is if you state it as factual of this is your problem, they're automatically going to be more defensive than if you approach it in a much softer way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's really the resistance that I need that I'm struggling with getting around, and that's a way that I hadn't thought of getting around it. So that's helpful. Yeah.
Cool. Ed, you and I had a conversation a while back too about, and this also is part of not being attached, is realizing that, you can use every tool that we've got to try and get someone to change, but we also have to decide as managers, if somebody wasn't going to change, am I willing to continue to have this relationship with somebody? And sometimes we have to, we have to end a relationship, which might mean letting somebody go, once we recognize, wait a minute, if they don't change, I can't afford to have that kind of energy around other people.
Right.
So there's a balance there. It requires discretion. I can't sit here on the phone and say that I would always know what the best move is with each relationship because they're all unique. But all I'm offering is just, hey, here's some tools to think about as you're having these conversations. Cool. Ed, I appreciate the question. Any other, and I can see all of you guys. I can see you. So any other thoughts or questions on anything that we've discussed so far? I know that, a lot of this is, it's a lot of material, and I'm just curious, as you guys are hearing it, if you have any thoughts or questions. Well, silence is a good thing. Silence is a good thing. That either means we've really covered everything there is, or that people are gone. But you guys are here.
Well, you're thorough, John, so it wouldn't be surprising that people are on the same page with you.
That's okay. Guys, well, on that note, turn the page to page 4 if you have the handout. If not, we're going to keep cruising through here. So what we've been talking about so far is the idea of some questions to prepare for coaching conversations. What I want to talk about right now is an idea called strategic listening. And again, this is higher level. This goes much further above and beyond, basic coaching tips, but just something that you guys can think about applying when you go out and you talk with others. On your handout on page 4, you'll see something that I call the conversation structure diagram. And you may remember hearing this idea a long time ago from me. And it's the idea that whenever two people communicate, you always have what's above the surface and below the surface. And the idea is, hey, what's above the surface is what people talk about. It's what's visible. It's often where conversations start. What's below the surface is what we might call the unspoken or the invisible. And oftentimes we want to think of it as that's where we want to go with our conversations. I had a consultant to our business a couple of years ago, and he presented a question that I always thought was really interesting. And he used to say, where do you find yourself 10 minutes into any conversation? And he used to say, you can learn a lot just by looking at where you often find yourself 10 minutes into a conversation. What kinds of things are you talking about with people? What's the emotional level of that conversation? Does it become lighthearted or is it always serious? Do you stop and actually connect with people or is the goal to always get on to the next thing? It's just interesting for us to all think about where do we go when we converse with people? We all have different styles, and I'm not here today to suggest that any one way of doing anything is right or wrong. I think it's just important to evaluate this, though. In this particular topic of the structure of a conversation above the surface and below the surface is a big one, because it really can apply to all of our relationships and can affect our ability to coach others. What we call strategic listening, and there's some fill in the blank here on page 4. If you don't have the handout, you'll be able to follow along. There's 3 ideas related to strategic listening that, for now, I want to introduce. The first one is what I call listening to emotional intensity. I think it's just important when we're connecting with others that we always listen to what's their emotional intensity. You know, when you guys all jump on these calls and I ask, how's everybody doing? You know, each of you has something that you'll say, but, you know, and this is not a complicated idea here, but I'm usually listening much more to the emotion behind what's being said versus what's said. Because it's so easy to tell what kind of state of mind somebody's in if there's other things that are distracting them or putting them in a certain state. Now, just because we think that we might detect a certain emotional intensity, it doesn't mean we want to read anything into that. It just means, hey, that's an indicator to be aware of, just something to pay attention to. The second thing to listen for, and this is about strategic listening here, is when we listen for incongruency, listening for incongruency, right? And this can be really helpful when you're trying to coach a demonstrator and you're trying to have a discussion or a conversation and you know, maybe it's near the beginning of the conversation and you ask someone how things are going and they say, everything's great, right? You're like, oh, really? Right, everything's great, right? That's like the person who says, I think having fun in life is so important, right? There's just a little incongruency there, right? Or the person who says, yeah, you know, I'm pretty motivated to sell blenders, right? There's an incongruency, right? So incongruency, again, is part of listening to emotional intensity, but it's different. It's, does the emotion behind what somebody's saying, does it match what they're saying? Now, my guess is that as I'm describing this, you guys are probably all thinking, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You probably, you know, you guys intuitively all the time are looking for incongruencies. But I'm encouraging you to consciously look for it as well, because incongruencies will tell you, hey, there's something, you know, there's something else that needs to be done here to crack open this nut. There's something that needs to, maybe I need some relationship building so that this person will open up a little bit more. Maybe I need to reveal to this person a little bit more about me so that they'll open up about themselves. You know, maybe I need to let this person know that it's okay to be dealing with a challenge or it's okay to not be motivated. Whatever it might be, all I'm saying when it comes to strategic listening is part of getting below the surface is just listening for these things first, right? It's just listening to, hey, what's the emotional intensity? What are the incongruencies? And point number 3 is this, listening for what's being deleted, distorted, or generalized. What's being deleted, distorted, or generalized, right? Because this is part of our natural communication patterns. We all do this, that whenever we internalize an experience or communicate an experience to others, you know, we all have a tendency to delete information. Someone says, how's your day? Well, I don't sit there and say, well, it's great. I had these 6 phone calls. We closed a deal here, and I, you know, walked the dog, hung out with my son. No, I say it was great, right? See, deleting information is actually a natural thing that we all do because otherwise we'd never get anything done if we really fully shared everything to answer every question or every discussion that came up. So it's natural. Distortion is normal as well. Think about when someone has a bad day demonstrating, right? And I think this is really important for us to be aware of this, that when someone has a bad day, you know, a demonstrator oftentimes faces as much rejection in one day as, you know, someone else who's not in a sales environment might experience in their entire career. I mean, it's night and day. When you look at someone who's in sales and all day long they're asking people to buy and you got, you know, 99% of the people in front of you don't really walk away with the product, there's a challenge there, right? And we have to recognize that that can affect people emotionally. Well, here's an example of distorting. You know, and this may not happen with someone who's been around a lot longer, but maybe someone who's a newer demonstrator, they have a bad day. You know, what's going to happen is as they internalize that event, they're going to distort it. And by the way, bad day is all relevant, right? I mean, we've probably all had 10-day road shows where you have one bad day, but you make them all up the next day. But somebody may not be in the state of mind to go, hey, you know what, I'm going to get them tomorrow, right? So what? Some will, some won't. Someone's waiting, keep going. They're not always going to have that positive self-talk. And so when I say distortion, sometimes distortion is when people will take a bad experience, and because they're emotional about it, they'll now use that lens to see everything else in the world. For example, they have a bad day, and so guess what? That's the lens through which they start thinking about themselves. They have a new self-identity. I'm no good. I shouldn't be selling blend. I ought to be doing something else. They have a bad day, and now they have a new lens that says, oh, this entire show is no good. The people here don't buy. Nobody buys blenders at this Costco or whatever it is, right? I don't know that your demonstrators ever think things like that. But the point is, we got to recognize that people will often distort reality. We all do it. It's natural. It's just part of being human and emotional. We distort reality, right? So just something to keep in mind there. We got to listen to see if somebody's deleting information, if somebody's distorting information, or generalizing. Sometimes they all happen at the same time. You know, generalizing is, you know, nobody buys because they had, you know, half of a day where nobody bought, right? So what I'm encouraging you guys to do here is just pay attention and listen for these things, because this will help you to get below the surface, especially when we start applying some of the ideas we talk about when we get to the next page. But before we do that, let me stop for a second. Any thoughts, questions, ideas, input, suggestions, feedback, anything at all on what we're talking about on page 4? I'm curious, because I respect that you guys, you know, spend a lot of time in the field, and I'm just curious as you're hearing this, if there's anything you hear and you go, oh man, that makes sense, or that makes no sense, or any thoughts at all before we move on?
That makes sense.
Thank you, Ed.
It's good. It's good. It's I'm digesting it. I've got like a million questions for you when we get together for for our one-on-one regional meeting.
Cool. All right. Any other thoughts, questions, ideas?
I've just been doing a lot of strategic listening, so I'm doing really good right now.
Good. You're listening for my emotional intensity, incongruencies,
right,
deletions, distortions, and generalizations?
There you go.
There should be a lot of them, so I'll test you guys at the end of this call. All right, good. All right, cool. We're going to move on, and what I hope you guys will appreciate is that, you know, a lot of this is information that lays a foundation. And actually, a lot of what we're going to talk about on the rest of this call is a little bit more of what you might call a how-to, a little bit more application. But at the level that you guys are at, and that's my way of saying I respect that, you know, you guys don't need someone to just tell you what to do, but what might serve you is just some of this different higher level education to just store away that it will, at the right time, you'll be able to rely on this information. So if we turn to page 5, we're going to talk about, and this is really a tool that we want to introduce today, which you guys may have heard me share a long time ago. And the first tool was strategic listening. And when you get good at strategic listening, you know, it helps you to get below the surface. And then what you combine with that is what we call quality questions. And the idea I want to introduce and dive into right now is the idea of coaching others through asking questions. And I know you guys gave me some good feedback on the audio CD that was sent to you a long time ago. But the first thing I think that's important we clarify, and remember on our very first call together as a group, I shared with all of you, I said, hey, I would encourage you guys to always hear these calls with multiple sets of ears, right? Ears as a peer, as a student, as a leader. Well, what I'm about to share with you, you know, you can use this when you're coaching somebody else on how to coach others. See, what we're going to talk about right now is, and you'll see this diagram, is why are questions powerful? And it's important that you guys not only be sold on why it's important to coach others through using questions, but how to sell someone else on why questions are powerful, right? And so if we start at the top and go around here, first of all, questions empower others to be solution finders, right? If someone says, well, hey, here's my problem, and Adam, I know you shared this a couple calls ago, that sometimes you might ask somebody, I think you were the one who said this, but you might ask them, well, what are you trying to solve that, or what are you doing to solve that, right? But questions empower somebody to get in the habit of solving their own problems, which is what we want. That makes it a lot easier to duplicate ourselves. Second thing here, questions inspire confidence in the solution, right? If someone's asking me for advice, and maybe I give them a little advice, but then I ask them, hey, can you see how you'd use that? Does that make sense? And I have them to also arrive at what's going to help them. They're going to have more confidence if they're part of the solution. Questions can be strategically chosen. That's why they're powerful. Because if you guys choose what you're going to ask, you know, you can literally decide going into any coaching conversation, how do I want somebody to feel based on what you say or what you ask? Because every question that you have has a certain wake to it, right? It has an emotional wake. Like I'll tell you guys that as I've been reaching out to your demonstrators who are going to be in the pilot group, you know, I've been there's certain things that I'm saying on the calls that because I want them to be excited to be in the group. You know, I don't want people to show up and not be excited. And you know, so I'll share with them, hey, here, you know, we had 150 demonstrators. We really only had, you know, 10 chairs in the room. So as we're thinking about who we wanted to fill in, you know, you're one of 11 people out of 150. And I'd say, hey, how does that make you feel, by the way? It's pretty cool, huh? And, you know, almost every single time, I'm saying that near the beginning of the call, they're saying, hey, yeah, that actually feels really good. And so you can be strategic with your questions so that you can help people to be in the emotional state that's going to be most empowering, right? I have a client of mine who works with Cutco. He's one of their top regional managers. And, you know, he always teaches his managers. He shares with them a story about when he was a young manager. And one of his reps, who went on to be one of the best reps in the company, one of his reps came into the office in the very beginning of her career. And it's like, you know, 2 days into the business. And she said, I've done 9 presentations and I've only made 1 sale. I'm ready to quit. And so this guy, his name is Jake. Jake said to her, he said, okay, so you've done 9 presentations, you've only made 1 sale. And he started asking questions, right? And he said, well, you know, tell me about your demonstration. And he noticed she's got a great demonstration. And then he said, well, tell me about your close. He said, have you memorized page 19? That was the close in their training manual. And she says, I haven't memorized it. And so by using questions, he figured out what the problem was. And then what he said to her next became kind of like a legendary example across the company of how to help somebody and put them in the right emotional state. He said, you don't even have your close memorized and you've actually made a sale? He said, I can't believe that. He said, you know, to not memorize your close and make a sale is unbelievable. That's amazing. How does that feel? And all of a sudden she thinks, oh my gosh. Wow, to have made a sale without having memorized my clothes, that must be really good based on what Jake just said. It rebuilt her confidence. She memorized her clothes, went on to be one of the top reps in the company. And she tells the story, too, about how funny that is looking back. But that's just an example of realizing that, look, when we're coaching others, we could take any situation where somebody might be down and disappointed, and through the right kind of conversation, we can help them to feel however we want them to feel. Right? That was a classic example right there. And Jake is obviously good at, you know, using his conversation skills and being aware of people's emotions, right, and how to move them to a better place. That's what it means when we say, hey, you can be strategic about asking questions. The next reason why questions are powerful is because they give the person that you're coaching control while also maintaining control. Isn't that interesting? When we use questions, we give somebody control because we're, you know, putting things in their court. Yet we also maintain control because we chose the question. And lastly is we keep others engaged. So what are some examples of questions when we're coaching? Let me rattle off 5 or 6, and you'll see there's space to fill this in your handout, and then we'll stop when we're done for any thoughts on this. Here's some really simple examples that I think are just powerful. When someone is sharing that they're having a problem or that something is not working in their demonstration, I think it's always important to ask at least a couple questions before offering any insight. So at a very minimum, one of the best questions to ask somebody is, really, can you tell me more about that? Can you tell me more about that, right? Because we have to remember, people delete information because it's needed as a human for us to be effective and efficient in our conversations, right? So first thing I'm working on is let me just get everything out, right? Well, can you tell me more about that? Another great way of getting more information is, well, can you tell me what specifically is challenging you? What specifically? And that word specific is a good one because it focuses people to get detailed. On one of our future calls, when we talk about what we call meta programs, which is how people organize information in their heads, we're going to talk about the idea of chunking and how some people think in chunks of large information, like big ideas, general ideas. Some people are always stuck in details. A great leader can go back and forth from both. Well, sometimes you have to get somebody to get detailed with what their problem is, right? So what specifically is challenging you, right? So these are the types of questions that just help us to gather more information. Here's another good one. Another good one is, well, can you paint a picture for me of what happened? Can you paint a picture of what happened, right? And that's nice because what you're doing is you're actually getting that person to go back to the scene and recreate the story of what happened, right? Can you paint a picture of what happened or what went on? All right, so these are questions that gather information. Other questions would be something when you're trying to get information. Well, let me just give you some more questions here. So what specifically, can you tell me more about that? Can you paint a picture of what's gone on? When you're moving in the direction of helping somebody to solve the problem, you can ask somebody, hey, what do you think caused the problem? What do you think caused the problem? Or what do you think you could improve? Or why do you think that happened? Why do you think that happened? It's that that question alone is one of the most valuable because it shows you right there if somebody understands the why behind the what, right? Why do you think that happened? Why do you think you didn't make the sale, right? And if they say, I think it's because I put too many carrots in there, and you realize it's just because they're not connecting with customers, you start to see where you need to help them, right? Why do you think that happened? What do you think you could have done differently? Now you start shifting that person to solving the solution. Right. Sometimes what you can do is you can combine coaching somebody with question asking. Let me give you a good example. One of my favorites when I'm working with somebody and I can recognize, especially if someone's been around and I've told them what to do and they're just not doing what they know. And I know in my core, in my heart that, okay, this person knows what to do. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll share with that person. I'll say, you know, Adam, one of the things that I found is that after being around for a while, sometimes things that are easy to do eventually get easy not to do. And I'm curious, when I share that with you, that sometimes things that are easy to do become easy not to do, is there anything you can think of in your demonstration that is easy to do, but for whatever reason, you've just allowed it to become easy not to do? And that's a great question. Again, hey, is there anything you can think of that is easy to do, but for whatever reason, you've allowed it to become easy not to do? That's a great question to help people to see, oh, you know what, I've gone away from what worked, or I'm just not doing what I knew worked a long time ago, right? So that's a good example of how I also gave that person a little bit of coaching, but you notice I didn't give them the answer, even if I knew the things they weren't doing. What I'd rather do is I'd rather give them that fishing rod so that in the future they can use that question on their own so that they can then solve their own problem. Because if all I do is say, no, you need to do this, this, and this, they don't have the tool to go in on their own and solve that problem, right? That's the power of using questions, right? So those are some examples of different questions. You know, we could get into more examples, but I'm hoping that what that gives you an idea of right there is, hey, you know what, just by using these questions, asking people to paint a picture, give me more information, tell me what they think the problem is, what should they do to solve it, you know, how can you can see how that can get somebody's brain going in a positive direction. So let's do this for a minute. I'd like to stop because, again, I know there's a lot of information. I want to stop for a second and just see if you guys have any thoughts or questions or your own experiences to share, insights, examples around or related to this topic. I'm just curious.
Hey, John. One of the things I've noticed sometimes when I'm out in the field working with different reps and you're trying to help them find tools to improve their skill set to close more sales, sometimes if you know, kind of do a briefing and say, okay, well, if you want to do more sales, you got to do this, this, and this, and this. I noticed you weren't doing this. It kind of puts them on a defense. But if you take some of these questions and be a skillful question linguist, you can ask the questions that lead them to self-discovery. And with some of these questions that we have here, I think it'll definitely improve my ability to take, you know, because, you know, your upper-level reps sometimes don't always listen because they think it's being done the best they can and all they need is just better shows.
Yeah, yeah.
So being a good conversationalist, asking good questions can lead them to self-discovery of what they need, which is it holds more value if they discover it rather than you telling them, oh, here's what you're not doing.
Yeah. Yeah. what I like about the example you just gave, Larry, is, you know, you just pointed out that you guys on this call, you guys all know what people need to do to close more sales, all right? Or, you know, it's safe to say you know more than your demonstrators do. You obviously have tools to give them. And I think, Larry, what's great about the example you just gave is you notice how if you take the example that I gave all of you, you can take what you just gave, Larry, and make the most subtle adjustment to where instead of it becoming a, hey, here's why it's not working, you could take that, like you just, you know, you mentioned, hey, what, you know, we know that what allows you to close sales is this, this, and this, and this. You could combine that, you could actually place that as the front end of a question and say, hey, well, you know, Larry, like if you're the demonstrator, instead of saying, well, Larry, you know, it's this, 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 and this, and here's what you're missing, where that'll make you defensive, I could say, well, Larry, you and I both know that closing a sale comes from this, this, and this. You know, which of those do you think it could be, right? So you notice also by saying you and I both know that it's this, this, and this, I'm actually starting with what's called an agreement frame. And by using an agreement frame, as long as whatever I say after that is not crazy psychobabble, right? If I say, hey, you and I both know that what causes closing sales is if you dye your hair purple and you do jumping jacks, well, I've lost your agreement. But if I say anything that makes sense, to say, Larry, you and I both know that what causes closing sales is, you know, the right flavors, connecting with customers, asking them to buy, and being likable. Is there anything that, you know, if whatever it is that you use as your framework, it makes some sense, by saying you and I both know they're going to agree, and so now you say, hey, which of those do you think it could be? By starting with an agreement frame, and then you say, which of those do you think it could be, you're more likely, doesn't mean it's always going to work 100% of the time, you're more likely to get someone to say, or to be more involving in the conversation versus defensive. So you notice you can take what you already are doing and just a very, very subtle adjustment and turn it into question asking. It's not like you have to learn a new language. It's just a real subtle adjustment. So I'm glad you gave that example. Does that help at all as I take that and give you that example?
Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
Yeah, that's cool. Any other thoughts, questions, ideas here around this topic of coaching through using questions?
Any advice on how to get over the obvious? Because, you know, when you're asking questions and the solution, you know, and when you're asking, well, why do you think that is, you know, and all they say is, well, because customers aren't buying. There's no one here at the store. There's nobody to talk to. They're, you know, just these excuses where you're just not quite getting that the longer, you know, the more you do the demonstration, the more people are going to see it, the more people are going to see it, the more people are going to buy. But if you just have this, you know, going into the store with an attitude, then you just might as well close up the show and call it a night because, you know, your attitude is already out of whack. And, it's just trying to get over that hump of beyond the obvious.
Yeah, that's good. This is a good question, right? This is a good question. You know, the first thing I would suggest, Greg, is to, and I'm glad you brought this up, right? Because this is going to happen. First thing I'd suggest is that you recognize that oftentimes when we begin a discussion with somebody or a conversation, you know, they may not show up to the beginning of that conversation the way we want them to show up, right? Like you just gave an example where, you know, if you ask them, hey, what's wrong? And they're going to say, well, the store sucks. Well, the problem is you don't want to sit there and have the conversation about whether or not the store sucks because that's not the point, right? So what you want to do is you want to move the conversation. And one way to move that conversation, if someone says, hey, the store sucks or whatever, is say, and by the way, always agree with somebody. Don't disagree with them. Because as soon as you disagree with anything, they now disagree with everything, right? Because they're looking for reasons to battle you because they're already pissed off because they think the store sucks and they think they can't do anything about it, right? So if they say the store sucks, you might start by acknowledging and say, hey, I'm not going to disagree with you. Obviously, you're going to have times where you have more people, and obviously, you're going to have times where you have less people. So you notice, by the way, that as I'm moving the conversation, I'm acknowledging, but I'm also using what we'd call transformational vocabulary to change it from the store sucks, the sky is falling to, hey, I can't disagree with you. We'd probably both agree that there's going to be times where you have more people and times you'd have less people, right? So what I'm doing is I'm taking some of the negativity out of it. I'm keeping it real by saying, hey, I'm not going to disagree. You're going to have times where you have more people and times you have less people. And then where I'm going to take that conversation to is at some point I'm going to say, let me ask you this, though. You know, my job is to help you maximize whatever you can. So would you be open to talking about how we can at least get the best results out of what you have here instead of focusing on what we can't control? Right? And at that point right there, I'm putting it on your plate. I'm saying, look, you know, do we want to have a productive conversation or are we going to focus on what we can't control? And the way I phrased that hopefully is a healthy invitation for someone to say, okay, yeah, well, let's talk about what we can control. So I'm moving the conversation. I'm also reminding you as the demonstrator that, hey, my job is to help you to maximize what you have. And so I want to talk about that. Can we talk about that instead of, you know, the fact that the store sucks, right? I mean, it's okay to be totally real with people and real on all sides of the equation. Real, hey, okay, this place is no good, but at the same time, my job is to help you to get better. Can we talk about that? Can we see what we can do to maximize it, right? And I'm not saying that what I just gave you guys is going to work 100% of the time, but what I am suggesting is, look, we don't want to feed into the negativity and feed into their belief system or their story. That's what I mean by, look, don't get attached to it, right? What we want to do is acknowledge it and then move them over to the productive conversation. And if somebody were to consistently say, hey, no, there's nothing I can do to them, if someone really said that, you know, what that tells me is I, as the leader or the manager, need to reestablish my relationship with this demonstrator. And if I attempt to do that and they won't allow me to, then that person, you know, then I need to start making other decisions. But what I mean by reestablish my relationship with that demonstrator is at some point with all of my demonstrators, I need them to know that I understand that not every store is going to be the same. My job, though, is to make sure that they are constantly getting better, and I have the tools to give to help them with that. So let me stop for a second, Greg, and just ask, what I've shared so far, does any of it make sense, or does it help at all?
Yeah, I agree with if you I especially agree when you said that, you know, they're wanting the battle, and if you encourage that, then once you say one thing that's challenging, then everything else is going to be challenged as well. That is absolutely true, and hard to avoid, easy to get into that kind of trap, but definitely some skill sets to work on to avoid that.
Yeah. I think what you just pointed out might be the most important element of that conversation, which is align with your demonstrators. You know, there's no need to debate something that's just not necessary. Align with them. Say, yeah, you know what? The store isn't ideal. I know what you mean. But hey, while we're here, while we're talking, should we look and see? You know, it's almost like it's just an invitation to, hey, should we look and see if there's anything we can do to get better? And part of the responsibility does lie on us to make sure that we've earned the respect of our demonstrators. And sometimes the way that sometimes earning the respect only happens over time when we give them enough insight that they realize, oh, wait a minute, that was a good idea. Like, I don't expect you guys to respect me just because I'm hosting these calls. My guess or my hope would be that it's only over time. You know, once you get enough ideas, you'll realize, okay, you know, these are valuable. I don't feel like I've earned that just because we're here. So we have to remember that.
I agree with you on that. And I find it a challenge with only a certain few, not all of them. You know, yeah, you can commemorize, you know, and commiserate with a fellow demonstrator. And yeah, I'm sorry, the show is stinking on you. But then others like to spiral from there. And want to, you know, well, why did you send me here? Why did we even do this show? You don't know what you're doing, you know, and this, that, and the other. And it's like, well, okay, now you're firing barbs at here, you know, barbs at me. And now the conversation's changed a little bit, to say the least. But to try to avoid them spiraling and all that, you know, that's also a part of the challenge as well with the conversation in the coaching moment. In trying to keep them, well, okay, well, what can we learn from this slow store? You know, let's work on our recipes. Let's work on our pitch. you know, let's work on this challenge in other ways as well.
Yeah. Hey, when it starts to spiral out of control, that's when things get entertaining, Greg. That's when we earn our regional manager pay.
Got that right. Well, not this month, though. Not this month, though, John. That's another story, though.
Oh, man. Well, hey, we're going to be talking about this on a future call on the topic of coaching conversations when we get into some, you know, just more tools to use. But I'll plant the seed now. One of the tools that we're going to be talking about is interrupting somebody's pattern. You've got to keep in mind that sometimes people fall into patterns, emotional patterns, conversational patterns, belief patterns, relationship patterns, performance patterns. And sometimes to break somebody's pattern, we need to respond or do something that's totally the opposite of what they're expecting and what we would normally do. So just keep in mind that doing whatever it takes sometimes means that we as the coaches have to go outside of our comfort zone, even when that means, you know, someone says, hey, this show sucks, and they think we're going to battle them, to say, yeah, I actually think it really sucks. I mean, sometimes you've got to break someone's pattern for them to listen to you. And we'll talk more about that, but I'm just throwing that idea out there right now. Greg, I appreciate the question. It's obviously relevant. Any other from Ed, Adam, Tim, Larry, any other thoughts or questions on what we've been talking about here?
Well, one question I have is if we argue more with our demonstrators, does that mean that we earn more? Is that what you said about that's how we
Yes, Larry, I'm going to argue with you right now that that is a correct statement.
I haven't found that to be the case yet, so apparently I'm getting quite a bit of money.
You know, the more I argue, it doesn't
seem to have disagree
more
money with
you, Ed. I thought I'd make light of something that seems kind of heavy.
That's good. That's good.
Thank you.
I would appreciate if you guys can take as much of what we talk about out of context as possible.
John, I have to apologize. I have to get off this phone for a little bit. Do you know how much longer we're going to be on so that I can come back on, or I need to listen to it later? I just have an issue that I
three to 4 hours, depending on Tim's questions. It would be probably 15 more minutes.
Okay.
The variance depends on you know, if people have thoughts or questions, but everything's being recorded, so you're good.
Okay, I apologize. I may not make it back, so if I don't, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
It was a really good meeting.
Cool. Any other thoughts or questions, Tim or Adam, on what we talked about before we go on here? All right, cool. If you guys have your handouts in front of you, you're welcome to turn the page. And this will get interesting. It's too bad Ed has to leave now. This will be interesting. Page 6, we're talking about what we call psychographic priorities, and we'll talk about what that means. It's that word has too many syllables. Psychographic priorities and motivators. You know, what we're talking about, what we're going to shift gears to talk about right now, we've talked about the idea so far today of listening, using questions when we're coaching others, and these are conversations that could be really extensive. But what I want to do is introduce an idea right now that has to do with understanding how people think, right? And this is really what we'd call, you know, a higher chunk or a big picture idea, or a general topic as to how people think. And you'll notice if you've got the handout, I've got this kind of diagram that's been created so that you can see this visually. And what we're going to talk about on page 6 here, the idea of global values. What does that really mean? Well, let's talk about the demonstrator for a minute right now. I'm about to make some generalizations, right? And as I've told you guys, that's normal. But I'm going to make some generalizations that I don't want you to hear this and think, well, this describes everybody or this is true 100% of the time. Just understand that this is a generalization. And as we talk about really how people think, that's what we're talking about. On page 6, we're talking about what's the difference between how a demonstrator thinks and how a Vitamix executive thinks. And when we say Vitamix executive, we're really talking about you guys. Now, the interesting thing here is you guys actually have to go back and forth between both models of the world. But when we talk about the difference between how a demonstrator thinks and the difference between how you as a Vitamix executive think or should be thinking, what you'll notice here is why it is that there is so much conflict and that conflict is normal, right? And by seeing this on paper, what my hope is that a lot of the conflicts that we might have, we can alleviate or even resolve by using this information, by knowing, hey, understanding, wait a minute, this is what this person values, and here's what I value, and now that I know that, I need to make sure that when I come into a conversation, you know, I am acknowledging, and I'm understanding, and I'm even utilizing my awareness of, hey, how does this person think compared to how I think? And I think you'll see how this all comes together really nicely. So where it says demonstrator, you're going to see there's three fill-in-the-blanks underneath the word demonstrator. And if you don't have the handout, you'll see to the right of this is the same thing, but instead of the word demonstrator is Vitamix executive. Might as well say regional manager, right? So where it says demonstrator, what I want to introduce is this thought that as somebody becomes a demonstrator, they have a natural order of priorities, meaning to be a successful demonstrator, I actually have to have a certain set of values that allows me to succeed as a demonstrator. So the first one is what we call the individual, right? And this is in order of priority, because I want you to think about this for a minute. When you get into being a demonstrator, your success relies on you caring about yourself and nobody else. I mean, think about it. It doesn't matter what the team is doing. It doesn't matter what the company is doing. For me to succeed as a demonstrator, I really need to be focused on hitting as many sales as I can. Now, you guys, you might have a little voice in your head that says, well, that's not true because they succeed because the customers are seeing all these other demonstrations. Well, we know that that's true, but from the demonstrator's perspective, you know, when anybody gets into sales, especially when they're an independent contractor, when anybody gets into sales, in order to be successful at selling, we have to develop a part of ourselves that it's a drive. And, it, you know, someone might look at it as self-serving, but it's really a needed drive to take care of myself, right? Because I get paid to produce results. I don't get paid for anything else right now. I've got to produce results. So that's why we say that a demonstrator values the individual, meaning themselves, their own results, the things that they want out of the job, the things that they want out of their lives more than anything else. Number two behind that is what we call the team. And the whole point here is that at a very deep level, we have to understand that this is how people will prioritize their values. Someone who is an independent salesperson and demonstrator, at a core level, like a primitive level, they're going to care about themselves first. They're going to care about the team second. Now, does that mean that someone doesn't care about the team? No. Does that mean you don't have team players? Not at all, right? And, you know, you think about people who've been around longer and longer, they probably get better at valuing the team. But everyone always has to put themselves first. When the role that you're in, you get compensated, you survive based on your success, right? Now, I know that when you have people working together, there gets to be a point where, hey, if I can help the person working with me and we're sharing commissions, then that becomes equally as important. But my goal of introducing this to you guys today is for us to imagine, well, if this is true, what John's explaining, you'll see why it explains a lot of the challenges that we have. So the priorities of a lot of demonstrators might be, hey, myself first, maybe the team is right there second, and then M stands for the mission of the team or the mission of the company, right? The demonstrators, hey, I love Vitamix. It's an amazing product. It changes lives. But again, them hitting their sales goals, them being able to pay their bills is probably always going to come ahead of does the company hit their sales goals, right? And that's natural and normal. What we're not talking about here, this is not a moral or ethical thing. We're not saying this is good, bad, right, or wrong. What we're talking about is the natural progression of how somebody in a certain role really develops their priorities, okay? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to switch sides, and we're going to look at how does an executive need to prioritize? Now, you guys already know what the blanks are, and you'll notice that all we're doing is we're reversing the order, right? If we were to imagine that you guys are each owners of the Vitamix company, right, and you had to think as an executive, right? What becomes more important than anything is the mission of the company. And for each of you, the way you could interpret this is the mission of my team. That's the most important thing. Secondly is the team itself, right? You actually have to separate those. And third is the individuals on the team. Now, does this mean you don't care about the individuals? Not at all. Does this mean you don't help people? No, that's not the point. The point is, as a smart executive, you're probably going to be careful to not make decisions that might serve the individual before they serve the team. Because as soon as you do that, right, then that causes a lot of other problems. So the whole point is, when you focus on the mission of the team first, and hopefully we all understand that if as an executive we're always trying to make decisions based on what serves the whole, you're actually serving everybody more than if you just focused on one person at a time in terms of priorities. Okay, remember, we're talking about priorities. It doesn't mean that we don't care about the team or about individuals, but in terms of what our priorities should be, right, if you want to look at it that way, you could look at it that way. Now, again, all I'm giving you guys is a framework here. It doesn't mean this is always the reality 100% of the time. I told you in the beginning, these are some big generalizations. But hopefully, as I'm sharing this, you can agree enough with the idea of, okay, I can see the difference here between, as a demonstrator, I have to learn to focus on what serves me because that's the only way I get compensated. You got to think about it that way too. Compared to as an executive, you know, this in general, I have to learn how to think about the mission of the team, not just because you get compensated that way. That's just how you're going to survive is by growing your organization, right? So when we look at that framework, what this helps us to do is to understand when we go into our conversations why it is that we often have challenges. And I'm going to suggest this. Oftentimes that when we as regional managers go into our conversations, we have the mission of the team in mind. That's the most important thing because we know, hey, that you know, we need to be doing things a certain way. People need to be hitting certain goals. Collectively, there's a mission of the team. And when we go into our conversations with a demonstrator, sometimes, I'm not suggesting this is what happens when you guys talk to your demonstrators, but it's good to recognize that this happens. Sometimes we will make a mistake by approaching them and trying to get them to value things in the same order that we do. In other words, what I'm suggesting here is it's okay to acknowledge that even though we have things we want people to do because it serves the company, because it serves the team, we have to realize when we go into our conversations that ultimately people will do things to serve themselves first. Now, I'm not saying that because this is meant to be some sort of doom and gloom, depressing view of people in the world. What I'm saying is it will serve us to recognize that people are more likely to do something to serve themselves first than they might be to serve the mission of the team. Does it mean that people won't care about the company goals or what you want people to do because that helps the organization? No. I'm just saying that when you order the priorities, it will usually serve us when we go into a conversation to stop and ask ourselves, what matters to this person? What matters to this person right here? And if you have your pen, there's a real interesting way of looking at this. If you can help somebody, like several of you have actually asked the question over the past three calls now. Two of you have asked almost the same question, which is, you know, John, sometimes I'm trying to get people to comply, I'm trying to get people to do certain things, whether it's administratively or compliance issues or to do something a certain way because we all know that the company needs something done a certain way. And we have to recognize that the company has reasons that, you know, as an executive, you have to choose to respect, right? Doesn't mean you always agree with it. You just have to respect it. And so the point here is when you go into your individual conversations, instead of trying to get someone to care about what the company wants, it can be valuable instead to show somebody that the things that they want, which is to succeed as a rep, the things that they want, which is to hit their sales goals, the things that they want, which is maybe to achieve dreams or goals outside of Vitamix. That's an important point. That they will get more of those, right, by doing the things that help the company. So the point here in introducing these priorities is to make sure that we don't try and get people to care about the company goals, but instead to show them that we understand what their goals are and how that actually by them hitting their goals, that helps us hit our goals in terms of the company. Let me give you an interesting example. I have a friend by the name of Matthew Kelly, and he wrote a book called The Dream Manager. It's a great book. And The Dream Manager is a New York Times bestseller. It's really good. And it's a parable about the whole lesson it's teaching is that in the workplace, we ought to find out what are people's dreams and goals outside of the business. What are the things they want to achieve? Where do they want to travel? What are the things they'd like to own? What kind of lifestyle would they have? What would they like to do with their families? What are their intellectual goals, spiritual goals? What are all of their dreams, right? That's this whole dream manager.